Okay, today is December 16th, 2015. This is a follow-up interview with Kevin Riley. My name is Troy Reeves, and I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program, and we're here at Steenbach Memorial Library. So, Kevin, as with the first interview, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Yes, it's Kevin Riley, R-E-I-L-L-Y.
Great. I'm going to get this a little closer to you. All right, so we were just chatting just briefly before we turned the recorder on. There's some questions that I'd like to ask to get at a bit more information before you become system president. I don't know which one you want to tackle first.
Well, good questions about how extension fits or not within the system. Has the fit changed, and the Wisconsin idea, thoughts on it, and how did I practice it? So let me address those questions. There's a great photo that we have, fortunately, dating back to the early 20th century, of a person by the name of E.L. Luther, who was the first cooperative extension agent in Wisconsin. This was before the Co-op Act was passed nationally, and he was an ag agent in Oneida County, and he's arguably the first co-op extension agent in the country, as a matter of fact. And his job was to bring to the farmers in Oneida County the resources, the knowledge of the university about how to improve agriculture in his county. And the picture of him is in a sort of characteristically dressy, all-white suit of the time, standing in front of the Oneida County courthouse with a bicycle in front of him. And if you look closely at the bicycle, you'll see he's attached to the crossbar of the bicycle a two-cylinder engine. So E.L. Luther used this engine, this bicycle, to get around to his experimental plots and to the farmers in the county. And so I'd like to say that, you know, that really was a very, with the first extension agent in the state, very concrete example of educational technology, mm-hmm. information technology, right? Mm-hmm. It was that two-cylinder engine on that bicycle that allowed the dissemination of the knowledge from the university to the people who wanted it, needed it, in the agricultural world in Oneida County in the early 20th century. So if you talk about how extension fits in the system and how things have changed, you know, online education is just really a further extension of educational technology. And at every step of the way, there have been people saying, oh, we shouldn't go there, we can't do that, that will overturn everything we're about, that the university or extension. And my argument in most cases like this was, no, this really is the 21st century face of what E.L. Luther was doing at the beginning of the 20th century. So I think that it's a wonderful photo and very symbolic and in its own little way forward-looking if you read it right, or at least read it the way I do. One of your questions, Troy, too, is, you know, how did I practice it? Well, as the leader of the organization, you practice the Wisconsin idea all the time, I guess. But one interesting particular example to me, just sort of outside my job responsibilities, was that when I was a leader in extension, I was a itinerant lecturer for the Wisconsin Humanities Council. That organization, which is administratively attached to extension, independent with its own board and its own director, but administratively attached for support purposes, they have a cadre of people who have volunteered to go around the state and give talks on things they're interested in and know about. So the idea is, in the humanities, how do you get the humanities out in a public humanities way to people around the state? So I would go out when they had interest from people to talk about literature. My academic area is Irish literature and culture, so I'd typically go out and talk about Irish literature or James Joyce or William Butler Yeats in libraries and lodges and bars and other places around the state, and that I thought was kind of an interesting and fun way to very directly practice what the Wisconsin idea is about, and to do it not with agriculture or broadcasting or small business development, but with my own area of interest in the humanities. So I did that for a number of years. And then I guess just thinking of concluding what I wanted to say about extension, one of the great things working there was how passionate my colleagues were about the work that they did. I mean, they really believed in the Wisconsin idea, believed that it was a force for good in the state, a force for economic development, a force for improving people's quality of life, personal, cultural, economic, social, and they practiced what they did with a real sense of passion because of that. So I used to joke with the co-op people, especially once in a while, and I do this sometimes with the broadcasting people too, and say, look, you're not a division of extension, you're a cult, because you did have the sense sometimes that they were so passionate and such true believers that no matter what came their way, no matter what obstacles the administration and the person of me was going to throw in their way, they were going to get the job done. And I really liked that about working there. And that's not to say that that same passion isn't shared all across the University of Wisconsin. It is, but given the particular nature of that work and the uniqueness of it within the university, those folks had established bonds with their audiences and their clients and their students, if you want to think of it that way, that were very, very intense on both sides of that relationship. You don't want to be in public broadcasting when you move one of the radio programs in Wisconsin Public Radio from Saturday morning to Tuesday afternoon. You realize how attached people are, how big a part of their lives those programs become. Mm-hmm. And there's a passion there on the part of the audience as well as on the part of the people who work in public radio and public broadcasting and across extension. So that made it an intense but very fun and gratifying place to work.
So then, unless there are other things you want to say about those 8 years at Extension, my next question is, if you wouldn't mind describing the process towards becoming the system president.
Sure. So I was the chancellor of Extension for 4 years, and when Catherine Lyle announced that she was retiring, I'd worked pretty closely with Catherine over the course of those years because Extension, given its unique statewide mission, like the system administration, is relating to people and powers that be all across the state. So it's particularly important, I think, that the Extension Chancellor and the System President have a good working relationship and work together in the interests of the people of Wisconsin and the university. And we did. So we got along very well. So I had a chance to see the system president job up close through that working relationship. I had seen the SUNY system chancellor, as they call it there, the State University of New York. The CEO of the system is called the chancellor. In Wisconsin, the CEO of the system is called the president. Those terms are used interchangeably but differently in different states. So I kind of knew the job, and I thought, given my career, my experience, how long I'd been in Wisconsin and the kinds of jobs I'd been in my time of Wisconsin, that it was probably something I should look at. That was the positive side of it. The tough side of the decision was because I had worked closely in New York and in Wisconsin with the system head, I was pretty familiar with how tough a job it is. And it is a very tough job. You have many, many stakeholders and constituents. You finally have to do a lot of what you do by persuasion. It's not a top-down organization in a university system. And if you try to make it that, you generally don't last very long. But you have to move it. And you have to figure out a way to do that without, in a military sense, ordering people to the battlefront and all the battles. Mm-hmm. And you, in the course of doing that, you spend chits, and you're aware that you're spending chits as you go along. So I'd seen that, and, you know, I was interested. I did hesitate about it, partly, too, because I liked being extension chancellor so much. And, you know, in any job change, as you know, there's generally some pull to the new job and some push. You feel like you're ready, or you're being forced out of your current job, or you just want to get out of your current job. Well, in my case, I was not being forced out of the job of chancellor of extension. I didn't feel like I really wanted to leave that job. It was a matter of, is this the, you know, right next job for me to go to? So I concluded finally, after, you know, a lot of conversations with a lot of people, my wife included, saying, you know, are you ready to do this? And the kids too, although the kids were still pretty young at the time. So we finally decided, yeah, we would do it. And the extension job is a pretty public job. The system head job, especially in Wisconsin, where you have one large university system, is a very public job. And you are on the line in the public eye 24/7. You know, I think next to the governor, it's probably the most public and publicly exposed job in the state. And we have in this state strong, and I think it's good that we do, strong freedom of information kinds of laws that ensure public access to government activity and meetings and documents. And so everything you do, you have to do thinking, well, if this was in the headlines in the paper the next day, or the lead broadcast on a big TV station in Milwaukee, would you be comfortable? And, you know, if the answer is no, you shouldn't be doing it. So, I mean, I was aware of all of that stuff and more, and I was foolish enough to apply. Anyway, there's a great line that Mike Leavitt, who was a governor of
Utah,
I believe, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then became Secretary of Health and Human Services, and I think he might have been Secretary of another department at the federal level, but that he uses, which is a public service is full of people who don't know what they're getting into. And there's a little bit of that here. I knew a lot about it, but not everything I was getting into, because you don't until you're actually in the job, in any job. So I decided to apply. It was a national search with a national search firm that the Regents employed. There wound up being three announced finalists. One of them was the former congressman, Steve Gunderson, a congressman from the La Crosse area. Another was the executive vice president at the time of the SUNY system, ironically enough, Elizabeth, and I can't remember her last name right now. I didn't know her. She didn't come to SUNY, at least to that position, until I had left. I do remember the name. It's Elizabeth Capaldi, Capaldi. So we were the last three left standing after the sifting and winnowing of the search firm and the system-wide search committee that then recommended those three finalists to the small region committee that was focused on the search. And that region committee finally decided I was the person who ought to get the job. And then the process, Troy, is that region committee recommends the person they want to the full board of regents, which votes to appoint the president, which happened here. And I was fortunate that I came in with a unanimous vote by the board of regents to appoint me.
Was there steps that you had to go through to become one of the three finalists?
Sure. It's an elaborate process, and you know, it's laid out, a lot of it, in region policy. So you submit an application packet. the president of the board puts together a large system-wide search and screen committee. The board hires a search firm to work with them and the search and screen committee. The president of the board appoints a smaller committee of regents only, who is the sort of regent search and screen, if you want to call it that. It's really the regent selection committee for that search. So you have a bigger, broader, system-wide search and screen committee, which includes typically a couple regents, but some students, professors from a variety of campuses, administrators, at least one sitting chancellor. The chancellor on the committee that recommended me was the chancellor at the University of Wisconsin-Platteville. So it's, you know, some academic staff, some outside folks, often a couple community people who are outside the university. And that committee, that big search and screen committee, is charged by the board president then to working with the search firm to review the resumes they get and sift and winnow through them to a point where they would invite a number of semi-finalists, typically, and I think they did that in this case, to meet with them, and that, you know, number of semi-finalists might be 6 or 7, or I can't remember how many there were exactly in my case. And after interviews between the big search and screen committee and those semi-finalists, the search and screen committee goes back, sifts and winnows further, and gets it down to a number of finalists. In this case, as I recall, it was the three of us. And then those finalists are announced publicly. And at that point, typically the finalists will come back and do a presentation and further interviews. And then the region select committee, after those further presentations and interviews, will decide which person they want to recommend to the full board. Or I guess it would be possible, if they got there and really felt they didn't like any of the finalists, it would be very unusual, but it's possible they could say, we're going to abort the search and start all over again, which you don't ever want to do, but it's better than people having a feeling they're settling for an unqualified or underqualified candidate.
Right. So it sounds like it was 2 job interviews.
Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, I had both the advantage and disadvantage going through those interviews of being a known quantity to many of the people who were doing the interviews. And being an inside candidate is both an advantage and a disadvantage. And you have to really play it carefully. The other two were outside folks to the UW system, so they were not known quantities. Steve Gunderson, a little more known because of his career as a congressman, but still outside the university.
What was your presentation on?
Oh, I can't remember exactly, to tell you the truth. I think there were certain questions that they asked that they wanted you to address in the presentation, and vaguely, my memory goes back to, you know, it was really about, well, how should the system best work to deliver higher education, teaching, research, and outreach to the people of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. But I'd have to go back to look to get more specific than that.
So when they offered you the job, how much deliberation was needed?
By me?
Yeah.
Well, you know, by that time, it's an elaborate process, as I've just laid it out, as you can tell. And I also mentioned that before I threw my hat into the ring, I took a lot of time to think about it and talk to people. So by the time the offer was made, I was ready to say yes if the offer was going to be to me. I was ready to go back to being Chancellor of Extension if the offer was going to be made and accepted by somebody else. So very little time, as a matter of fact. But I like one of the advantages I felt I had was this. There's a great line by Saul Linowitz, who is a former chairman of Xerox Corporation, and then went to work for Lyndon Johnson as one of his cabinet secretaries in the Johnson years. And he had never been in politics, had never spent time working in Washington. He'd come up, you know, through the corporate ranks to being the head of one of the really big worldwide corporations. And after his experience in Washington, he said, don't go to Washington unless you don't need it. So I kind of had the sense that I didn't really need this. I was happy where I was, and other things might come along later, but I'd been chancellor of extension for 4 years, which is not a huge amount of time. I didn't feel like I'd spent all my chits there or knew everything there was to know, and I was bored there. So I kind of had a luxury of thinking a little bit about, well, is this really right for me? Is it right for the university? Do I feel like I can do the job in the best interest of the people of Wisconsin and all the other stakeholders outside of Wisconsin that the University of Wisconsin affects in some way or other? And I felt finally thinking it through. I thought it was right in the sense of the fit on all those considerations.
So what's the transition like? By that I mean, you know, do you recall how long it took to go from old job to new job?
It was not very long because in large part of Catherine Lyle's situation. So she had agreed that she would stay on. She was ready to retire, but she had agreed she would stay on through the search until the new person was selected. So as I recall, and I don't have all the dates in my head, but as I recall, fairly shortly after the decision was made, you know, Catherine and I sat down, and she sat down with the chair of the board, and we had a date when she was going to step out and I was going to step in. So it was a short transition and pretty seamless, as I recall.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when you take over as system president, are you able to bring in people underneath you, or do you inherit, or is it a little bit of both?
Both. So you inherit the people who are there, and you have the ability to bring in new people. And what I did, and I think it's healthy, it's never easy, but over time, most of the senior leadership did leave. I brought in new people that I had hired, and there was a smooth transition there, despite really over time totally new personnel in all the senior positions. And you know what I always try to do in that kind of environment is have people leave as comfortably as you can make it for them to leave, because all these people were people who'd given good service, whom I knew because of my work in the system previously. So it wasn't like, again, I was coming in from outside and just looking at an organizational chart. I knew the people and liked them. But at the same time, there were things I wanted to do. There were people I wanted to have on my own team that I thought needed to step in at that point. So I did make changes, as I think most presidents coming in do. But I think it's a mistake if you come in and you decapitate, you know, everybody in the senior positions at a level below you or two within the first 6 months, because it makes the organization dysfunctional and people watch. It's if you're doing any personnel changes early on, and I did a few early on, it's one of the first things people watching you as the new president see you doing. And it's done in public. None of this is a secret. And how you do it then becomes a kind of signal, at least gets read as a signal by the people who work in the organization and all the people watching outside of it, what kind of a president you're going to be and what kind of a person, indeed, they think you are. So I think it's very important that be handled deftly.
So who did you bring in right off the bat?
I brought in the sitting chancellor at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, whose name is Don Mash, M-A-S-H. I brought him in as my executive vice president. So he was the number two person in the system administration, and he had experience as a president in the Nebraska system, and then he'd been chancellor at Eau Claire in our system for a good number of years, been successful, you know, had the respect of people around the system, and people knew him around the state. I brought in as my chief of staff the retired vice chancellor for administration and fiscal affairs from Extension. So that Bob Anderson, whose name I mentioned to you yesterday, he had actually retired from Extension, but I asked him to come back to work for a couple years to help me kind of get set up as my chief of staff. I did bring in David Giroux as the director of communications. Again, he had been in a similar position in Extension. So my executive assistant in Extension, Rita Sears, after a while came to be my executive assistant at the system. So you're seeing a pattern already of people I'd worked with in Extension coming to the system office. There were some structural changes. So there had not been an executive vice president under Catherine, but I put that position in place with a seasoned chancellor in it, and he really oversaw the non-academic part of the system administration. And although he was serving as a deputy too. And then there was a vice president for academic affairs, academic and student affairs, who oversaw the academic side. Cora Marrett was the person who was there. And she stayed for several years and then went down to NIH as the head of one of their divisions. And then I brought in Rebecca Martin as the chief academic officer in that VP position, who is the provost at UW-Parkside. And then when Don Mash, after a couple years, decided he was ready to retire, I hired Michael Morgan, who was the head of the Department of Administration for the state, as the administrative and budget person. The chief personnel officer retired pretty quickly, George, and then I promoted Al Crist, C-R-I-S-T, to be our associate vice president for human resources. Eventually hired in Vicki Washington as the head diversity person, whom I mentioned before I'd worked with at Extension. So there's a mix, you know, you can see there's somebody from state government and Michael Morgan, somebody from a campus, UW-Parkside, Don Mash from the Eau Claire campus, some people from Extension, some women, some men, some black, some white.
Right. Yeah. How much liberty do you have as system president just to hire somebody?
Theoretically, a lot. But you better be sure, especially at the very highest positions, that the people you're bringing in are not crossways with your board for some reason. So you need to consult with the board. Indeed, for the two senior VP positions that I had, one for administration, one for academics, we did write a policy while I was president that involves some members of the board in helping with the selection, and that's because Troy, it was the senior VP for administrative and fiscal affairs. Again, I think Ray has now taken the senior off, so they're VPs, not senior VPs. But these were the two deputies, co-equal deputy presidents, one for administrative and fiscal affairs, and that senior VP staffs the board committee on budget and fiscal affairs, and similarly, the senior VP, the VP for academic affairs, staffs the board committee on education. So the regents who are respectively the chairs of those two committees have a lot at stake in who this person is who you're bringing in, and all the regents on those two committees have a lot at stake. So there's a little more formal process of consulting with them, but it's always wise to do that.
When did you, or was there a moment? Let me back up. I've always been interested in sort of your welcome to moment. So, like, you know, NFL players, welcome to the NFL. I mean, you had been obviously sort of moving up, so to speak.
Right.
But was there a moment or a series of moments where it dawned on you that you are now the system president?
Yeah, I'll give you one an example of that. So maybe two. But at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on my first day in the job, we had an exit interview with the Legislative Audit Bureau on their audit of the university's administrative costs, university systems administrative costs. So this had been going on for, I think, years under Catherine Lyle, and they finally got to the end, you know, with the time they take to do their audit, and I sat in on that, and of course, whenever the audit bureau audits, they find things that they think need to change or bad. So that, I like to say I had a morning's honeymoon in the job. The other thing about sort of, ooh, you know, welcome to the NFL, welcome to the presidency is you, this was true again a little bit in extension, but much more intensely in this job. So you realize very quickly how people will interpret and, in most instances, misinterpret every shift in your body, every raise of an eyebrow, every twitch of your cheek, never mind the words that come out of your mouth. And, you know, 99% of the time it's misinterpretation. But they will read it and say, oh, my God, he's going to do this, or he meant that, or he's hiding this. Or so you just, again, learn very quickly that, you know, you have to be as direct and humane and authentic as possible. You can't prevent that misinterpretation from going on, but when you hear about it, you need to try to respond to it quickly, but it will happen. The other thing that surprised me a little bit, and, you know, people would say, well, now you're in the job, what surprises you about it, right? It's kind of another way of asking your question. Mm-hmm. And there really wasn't much because, again, I had worked so closely with this job over so many years. But the other thing that kind of surprised me a bit was how people would angle to get an invitation to come to Brittingham House, which is the home of the president. Mm-hmm. And you have, you know, many, many events over the course of the year, from football brunches to dinners to meetings to fundraising events, to student government meetings and events. And you realize, again, the kind of symbolic importance of the job and of the place where the president lives. People really like to come to the president's house and be there and say they've been there. This is true with Olin House for the Chancellor of Madison, and I think for the other chancellors as well. But that kind of surprised me about how intensely people would try to angle to get an invitation. And then the other side of that was, you know, you'd be out somewhere giving a talk and shake hands afterwards with people in the audience, and they say, oh, yeah, you remember me. I'm Joe, and I was at your house for the Purdue game 3 years ago. You know, and you have 250 people walk through the door, and that may have been the only time, you know, you met Joe or he met you. But, boy, he remembers that and wants you to remember that you had this previous acquaintance at your house, and he was there. And that's great. That's exactly what the venue should be used for, to build those kinds of relationships, in a sense that it's the, you know, sort of the people's house, open widely to people across the state, in a way of connecting with people and making connections finally between the university and the citizens of the state.
You know, I hadn't thought of it. I guess I never interviewed a former system president. I mean, I knew the chancellor had a house. I didn't realize the president had a house.
Yeah. Well, there's a very funny story about that, which I'll tell you, which is kind of germane. So when the system was put together in the 70s, early 70s, John Weaver was the first president. Didn't have Brittingham House at that time because, at that time, Brittingham House was the home of the Madison Chancellor. So the second president of the system, after John Weaver, was Ed Young, name you probably remember. He died probably about 4 or 5 years ago, not that long ago. He was the second president of the system. So he was the sitting chancellor at UW-Madison, became the second system president, and part of what he negotiated when he came in was that he and his wife were not leaving Brittingham House. He became the system president, so it became, at that point, the home for the system president.
So logistically, you get this job. Logistically, family-wise, you move.
Correct.
From wherever, I assume it might have been the house that you bought when you got here.
It was, yeah, up in the north side, yeah, exactly. And interestingly enough, the way this is done, and I think wisely, is as part of your contract or work agreement, you are required to live in the house, and part of that is for tax reasons. So the IRS doesn't say, wow, you're getting this huge benefit and it's worth X and Y. And no, you can say this is a condition of employment, a term of art in tax law. But it's also, you know, beyond that technical reason, it's also because the regents want you there, embodying the system at all the social events and parties and receptions and tailgates that you will have, and they want to have people come and think, oh, this is the president's house, and I'm here with the president and his family if the family's involved.
Mm-hmm. So, at that point, were the kids still in Madison schools?
Let's see. Yeah, they were. Probably like the two older, probably in high school, and the younger guy, maybe middle school or something like that. Yeah. But at least the two younger ones were certainly still in Madison schools.
So did that mean a change in where they went?
Part of the reason I'm hesitating is because with the youngest guy, we actually eventually sent him away to a sort of tough love school, mm-hmm. because right at that time he was having some behavioral mm-hmm. issues. So they all went. The simple answer to your question is no. The two older ones were at Edgewood, so they didn't have to move. Mm-hmm. But they both wound up leaving Edgewood and getting their diplomas from East, where they had started. And the younger guy wound up, when he got back from the tough love school, getting his diploma from East too. Okay. So all three of them are East High School grads, and I'm proud to say the younger guy is going to graduate from UW-Milwaukee on Sunday.
Yeah.
Finally, he made it through. He went into the military. And,
congratulations.
It was a long, long road, but he's finally got there.
Is Brittingham House off of Old Sock?
Yeah, it's right at the, it's kind of, you know where Crestwood School is there? So if you keep going up Old Sock, it's kind of the next driveway on your right. Between Old Sauk and Old Middleton, kind of. It's a beautiful house that was given by the Brittingham family, who were one of the original lumber families and European lumber wealth in Wisconsin.
So maybe just one more thing about that, because I've never had that situation. So, and sure. I'm guessing most people don't, that they, you know, get a job and you move into a house that's not only a living quarter, but also a public space.
Absolutely.
So, since you're the only one here, I'll ask just you, how was the transition from, a personal home to a personal home slash public public space.
Right. Well, yeah, for me, it was easy. I mean, and let me say, it's a beautiful house. It had been well maintained. It's on 14 acres of property in the Highlands section of Madison over there off Old Sauk. So, you know, anybody would be lucky to live there. And I really did enjoy it. And it, one of the nice things about it was you were not some campus presidents, and this is not true for the Madison chancellor either, but some campus chancellors or campus presidents have a house, you know, in the middle of the campus, and you just can never escape. Brigham House is a couple miles away off campus, as Olin House is. Olin's a lot closer, but at least you had a little bit of a sense of distance, which is good. But you are, it is a little like living over the grocery store, right? The grocery store is below, and that's public space, and your living quarters are above it. And, you know, the public comes, and, you know, we would find on a given football brunch people wandering around on the second or third floor of the house. And so it's an odd living situation in that regard. And I think it was, I know it was a lot harder for my wife, partly because in terms of things like decorations and paint, you really, you know, you can't do a lot, and you shouldn't, because you want to keep the cost down. And one of the ways that college and university leaders get in trouble really quick is, you know, they get appointed and they go in and they spend $1 million renovating the president's house. And if you, you know, want to sign a suicide pact, that's the way to do it. And it still happens regularly. So, you know, my mantra was no changes in this house in the public space, which needed changes in many ways. It was, the furniture was very old. Buzz Shaw's wife had bought it when he was the president way back, and the wallpaper was very old, but we kept it. So there were those kinds of feelings, you know. And but what a great privilege. I mean, it's a wonderful place, and as I said, the grounds are in a way the best part of it, in a neat neighborhood. And it was a place that people liked to come, you know, and people would come in the door and they were just so happy to be there that it was, you know, as even when you were really tired and you had another reception on another night, when the people would arrive, boom, you know, you'd feel great.
Was that from the energy of the people?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because the people were always so happy to be there.
We have a few more minutes, so I think we can jump into some of the...
Wow, that really went fast.
Yeah. Some of the key points.
Yeah.
You know, we're gonna do another interview or so, and you know, after the year,
sure,
after the holidays. So I don't know whether you want to start with the accomplishments or start with the large events and initiatives.
Well, why don't we start with the large events and initiatives?
Okay.
The growth agenda for Wisconsin is the first one that we've got listed, and I can say a few words about that. So, you know what. What we were seeing happening a little ways into my presidency was that Wisconsin as a state was falling farther behind other states in terms of the percentage of its population with a baccalaureate degree. And we believe that in a knowledge economy, a national and global knowledge economy, states that follow that kind of trend, we're not going to do very well in terms of their economic stability and development. That in a global knowledge economy, you need to have more people with some kind of college degree, not fewer people with some kind of college degree. And, you know, what gave a very pointed message about that was that, about 15 or so years before we started to work on the growth agenda, Wisconsin and Minnesota had about the same percentage of population with a baccalaureate degree. And Minnesota, as you know, is the state we compare ourselves to most frequently because they're probably the most like us of any other state in the union. And then when we started to look during my presidency, they had jumped about 7 percentage points out ahead of us in terms of the percentage of their population with a baccalaureate degree, and their per capita income had jumped up $4,000 to $5,000 ahead of ours in Wisconsin. So when we looked around the country, what we found was pretty much 1-to-1. The states that had the higher percentage of people with a college degree had higher per capita income. And you can argue whether it's causation or just coincidence, but that's the fact. And it's hard to believe there's no relation there between those two facts. So we set out in a tough economic time, to say, how do we be more productive as a university system in terms of the number of graduates that we produce for the state? And, you know, there are lots of side conversations you can have about that, because you produce graduates doesn't mean they stay in the state, obviously. But without going down that path very far, part of what we said was, well, we're going to also have, as part of this growth agenda, an emphasis on research and creating new jobs and new industries in this state coming out of the university. And if we do that part of it well, we'll hold more of our own graduates. And if we do that part of it well, we'll attract more graduates in to the state from elsewhere, where the taxpayers elsewhere have paid to have them get to baccalaureate degree, like yourself, Troy. We sat down with all the chancellors and provosts, but really started with the chancellors, and my laying out a case for them to say, don't we need to do this? I mean, we have an obligation to the people of Wisconsin to be more productive in terms of the number of graduates we produce from our system. And this was in the context of a larger growing realization. I think we were out ahead of the curve in many ways, but around the country, that the country was falling behind, right? So that when you look at the Organization for Economic and Community Development data, and they're an international group that tracks this kind of stuff based in Europe, the United States, again, 10, 15 years ago, had been the most highly educated country in the world. That is, it had the largest proportion of its population with some kind of post-secondary credential. Mm-hmm. We have now fallen back to, the last time I looked, it was something like 12, 13, 15 other countries jumping ahead of us. That trend, you know, cannot stay if we're going to be economically competitive as a country in the future. You know, we will not compete successfully in the low-wage market in this country. Mm-hmm. We've got to compete successfully at the high-wage end of things, and that means more people with more education. And, you know, we know now that the manufacturing jobs, for instance, that have been such a mainstay in Wisconsin and Wisconsin's success, and still are. I mean, we have a wonderful manufacturing sector, and it will be here and will be providing jobs for a long, long time. But they're not the same jobs, even in manufacturing, that we used to have. So the ability for somebody with a high school diploma only to step out with that credential and get a career in manufacturing, where they'll be able to support themselves and a family over 40 years of a career, really doesn't exist anymore. Why? Well, because if you go onto a manufacturing floor now, it's really about running computers. And people have to know how to do that, even the men and women working in what, you know, we think of as quote-unquote blue-collar jobs on the factory floor. And I was always careful to say, given that, you know, what I'm talking about here in a growth agenda doesn't mean everybody should come to Madison and get a bachelor's degree in history and go on to graduate school or law school. No, I mean, different people will want to do this differently, and a couple of my kids have gone to MATC, so I see it in my own family. You know, kid will want to get a one-year certificate in computer operations and go to work for a consulting company that helps companies, organizations maintain their back office computer infrastructure. Great. That's great. But the point is that we've really lost the ability for somebody to come out of high school, stop there, and live a decent life in this country. So our portion of it was how do we get more people to associate degrees in the university, but in particular with an emphasis on baccalaureate degrees. So we brought in an outfit called the Educational Delivery Institute to help us set this plan up. And I and my senior leadership at the system office worked with each chancellor and his or her senior leadership team at the campus to say, what's a reasonable target for you to increase your number of graduates by 2025? We set it out. And each of the campuses did this differently. Some would say, okay, we're going to increase enrollment, and we're going to try to hold more of them. Others would say, we're not going to increase enrollment at all. We're going to focus all our efforts on better retention. And we brought in some other outside groups to help look at what the barriers were at campuses to more students succeeding. For instance, if you looked at your data and found that a huge number of students were not making it through the initial math requirement that everybody had to take, what do you do about that? How's the math department teaching math? Is it the old style where they said, well, you know, math's really hard, half of you won't pass this course, and that's probably good? Or was it, you know, this is something you really are going to need to have in your background, you won't use it every day, but as a 21st century employee and citizen, and we're going to work with you to get you through this, but boy, you're going to have to work your butt off. It's not going to be easy because, you know, you've been a poet in high school, and now you've got to take advanced algebra here. But we're going to work. So that's just one example. We did bring in some outside folks to help us look at the barriers. Teams on each campus got put together, led by the provost, to say, where are the leaks in the pipeline, or where are the barriers? So some campuses focused on more enrollment, some on better retention of the enrollment numbers they had. Others said, we're not going to admit additional freshmen, but we're going to take more transfer students here, junior, senior year, and get them to graduate. So we put together a plan and called the Growth Agenda for Wisconsin that had a goal of having 80,000 additional baccalaureate degrees by 2025, beyond the number we would get if the current trends continued when we started. And each campus did it differently. Each campus worked with its local community and businesses to say, what do you need? You know, what kind of additional graduates do you need? Do you need more engineers? Do you need more nurses? Do you need more this or that? And that's a good example of how a well-functioning system seeds authority to the local campuses to deliver what they need for their region, rather than dictating from the center exactly how a campus is going to meet that new target, exactly what the degree mix will be. I mean, we had conversations about the degree mix, but finally they had to decide locally what was needed. Mm-hmm. So I asked the chancellors then, each of them, to get letters of support from local community people for their part of the growth agenda. So, there, you know, UW-Green Bay had it's the Green Bay growth agenda. UW-Oshkosh had the Oshkosh growth agenda, et cetera, throughout the system. And we got a wonderful set of letters and emails, and we put them together. And I remember going into Governor Doyle at the time with a physical binder, all these things on paper that was, you know, the size of the Manhattan phone book, and putting it on his desk and saying, this isn't just me or the regents asking you to fund this. You know, this is all these people around Wisconsin asking you to fund this on behalf of their organizations and regions and communities around the state. And that was right before the Great Recession hit, fortunately. So we did in that biennium, we got about $32-33 million new dollars into the university to help fund the growth agenda. And then we had an elaborate plan in place to track progress or regress on each campus. We had a team of people at the system that could help campuses if they got off track to figure out how to get back on. Again, some campuses needed more of that help than others. So we would check in periodically to see whether people were meeting their interim targets. So when you have a long-term strategic plan, you can't say in, 2010, oh, well, by 2025, we'll have this many and we'll look in 15 years to see if we did it. You've got to have regular yearly check-ins. So we did. We gave reports to the board. When I would do the chancellor's evaluations, performance evaluations every year, we would talk about whether they were on or off track in terms of those numbers and their plan about how they were going to reach those numbers. And when I left, we were despite the horrors of the Great Recession, we were still pretty much on track to meet those numbers. I don't know, honestly, since then what's happened with it, how much emphasis has been placed on it. Obviously, the university took a huge cut this time around. That doesn't help to motivate people to do this. But the fact is, one way or another, we need to figure out a way to do it. And, we talked a little bit about yesterday about adult students around the state, and they were a critical part of this plan. How do you get more of them to a degree? And again, if you have the right outreach and programs in place to work with them, they don't have to come in and take 120 or 130 credits. A lot of them may need half of that or a quarter of that to complete a degree, but you still get the degree. That's another number in that degree productivity target that's met. So we tried to work with the campuses again to sort of have that emphasis placed on adult learning. And I think one of the last things I did, and we can come back to this, before I left, was establish these competency-based degrees, which was one other step in trying to have degree programs that were adult student-friendly, quality degree programs that were adult student-friendly in the system to help get those numbers up. So it was after we had done that work and laid it out that the President of the United States kind of grabbed a hold of this and said, oh, as a country, we need to have 60% of our population with some kind of post-secondary credential by, I don't know whether he said 2020 or 2025. It's slipping my mind now, but it's one or the other. So it got raised in that sense to a national priority, not just a statewide one.
Well, we are just shy of an hour, so I think this is a nice place to wrap it up.
I think it is.
So this concludes the second interview with Kevin Riley. So thank you, sir, for your time. Appreciate
it. Thank you.